All right, then. A little sparse over here today. Partly my doing. Okay. Who all did questions for Hosea chapters 1 through 3? Okay. Good for you to have done them. There would be three people answering the questions. So we'll pass on answering the questions. Anybody have a question for me about the questions that you remember, that you thought of while you're going through it? You said, what does that mean? Okay. Again, remember the idea, and the idea is just to get us into the text, and you might figure out what my question is or not, but hopefully it will get you into the text and you can be doing your own thinking as you prepare to be here. Okay, so we're studying Amos. We're also in Hosea. We're also in 2 Kings 13, 14, and 15, which we'll, I think we'll get into all three of them today. We're in the reign. See, I forgot my little doohickey doodad at home, so I got to remember everything. Can you believe that? So we're in the reign of Jeroboam the second. Jeroboam II, his reign in the northern kingdom. We're studying Amos. We'll start with this question. The city attorney's office makes public a proclamation that says that you can no longer preach or teach about homosexuality or gender identity or things such as that. What do you do?
Don't stop.
You don't stop.
Invite him to come watch.
Amos. Amaziah said to Amos, go, you seer, flee away from the land of Judah, to the land of Judah, and there eat bread and do your prophesying, but no longer prophesy at Bethel, for it is a sanctuary for the king and of the royal residence. And Amos replied to him, this is a temporary job for me. You can't fire me. I'm going to say my piece. I'm not going to change the message. In fact, I'm going to add to the message because of what you have said to me, and then I'll go back home where I'm from. I'm the son of, he said, I'm not a prophet. I am not the son of a prophet, for I am a herdsman and a grower of sycamore figs. I was visiting my brother. Tim Reeves came over. We were chatting. I said, we're visiting Amos. And Tim said, that's one of my favorite passages. And he said, what are you going to do? Fire me? You can't fire a guy who's not, this isn't his job. One would say that it might be easier for him to say his, but it shouldn't be that way. Because remember, what all he was doing is, the lion has roared, who will not fear? The Lord has spoken, who can but prophesy? This is exactly what he was doing. When the proclamation comes down, hey, you guys, don't you be talking about that anymore, then all we can say, sorry, God has said, God has proclaimed. We have to just follow what he says. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you? So down there in Texas, in Houston, Texas, the mayor sent out, or she didn't, but the mayor's behind it, and they're all involved in it, and say, hey. And so I read, you know, this is making its rounds, and as it ought to, really. But I read on Facebook today, somebody that we know, a friend of ours, and some of you might know this too, know who wrote this. It was written, are we terrified that we may lose rights as American citizens? I don't think God wrote the First Amendment. In fact, I'm pretty sure he told us to expect the opposite, 1 Peter 2:13-25. Why not rather put our heart into the hope of an inheritance? Two things about this. Number one, amen. That's right. God did tell us, be prepared for the First Amendment to go away. Right? So, amen, put your hope not in America, not in our government, not in the laws that we have written, but in God. At the same time, we have to be full here. We have a First Amendment in this country. Is that a blessing?
Yes.
Why?
Because we're able to...
Say the right thing.
We're able to...
He already filled it out.
Speak his word.
Right.
Peace without fear of somebody...
come in and cut our head off.
Right. We are able to use that to exercise our right to free speech for going out and spreading the gospel. And in fact, he tells us, God himself tells us to pray for the First Amendment. Not really, but look in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Yes, right. Pray for the king. I urge, verse 1, 1 Timothy 2:1. I urge then, first of all, then I urge that entreaties and prayers and petitions and thanksgiving be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority. Mayor, what's her face down there in Houston? So that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. Tranquil, which means peaceful, right, and quiet. That means that we're not out there causing a ruckus. That's not what we're doing. But we are living it in godliness. And godliness includes what? Going out and preaching the gospel. Verse 3, this is good and acceptable in the sight of God, our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. Right, so pray for a country where you can live, where everything's at peace. And what's the end of the sentence is, so that, because God desires all people to come to the knowledge of the truth. Huh, I wonder what the connection is. The connection is, we use our freedom, and in our case, the First Amendment, to go out and preach the gospel. So yes, do not put your trust in government, but put your hope in the future. At the same time, be very saddened for God's kingdom and for the lost when these kinds of rights are being taken away. Be very saddened for them. Not because we can go and watch movies that have swear words in them because of the right to free speech, but because when that right is taken away, there's a lot of bad that goes with it, but there's a lot of good that is no longer possible. I don't mean it that we're not going to preach, but we use our rights to preach the gospel. Comments or questions on this?
And also the First Amendment is as part of we're allowed to meet.
Right.
Which, if that's taken away, we can't legally meet as a church.
Right, and if you take away the free speech part, why not the rest of it?
Yeah.
You know? Which, frankly, if you take away... By the way, it has to do with our society, and it has to do with the Bible, so I'm going to go ahead and say it. All right, so I used to live in Massachusetts, and a lot of you have lived in other places, like Atlanta. Anybody here been around Atlanta on 840, is it, that goes around Atlanta? I forget which one it is. How slow do they go? Right? In fact, you get a ticket for going too slow there. All right. So I went out to Boston, and the speed limit is 65. And you know what they're all doing? 85 or 90. And you know who's not stopping them? The police. And so you see, we nurture a mentality of, this law doesn't matter, this law doesn't matter, this law doesn't matter. And so what happens is, after a while, well, why do any of them matter? And that's what's happening. We have a whole entire nation of, did you see the debate where in Florida, where Governor Christ stood up? Okay, so it's something very stupid. He wanted a fan underneath his podium. It's a debate between a governor that wants to be and the incumbent governor. Okay, so he wants a fan in his podium. That's what he wanted. But the rules say no fans in the podium. I don't know why. Nobody knows why. But those are the rules. And Governor Christ said, he put a fan in there. What does that tell you about him? He doesn't care about the law. And do you know what anybody, the moderators, do you know what they said about it? Nothing. Again, we live in a society that doesn't care about laws. And if they don't care about one law, they're not going to care about the other law. So what does that have to do with this? If they're going to take away our right to free speech, why not take away all of our rights as the rights that we enjoy as Christians? Because guess what? We're still going to have to do what God says. The question is it going to be difficult or easy? Which do you prefer? Right? So just be prepared for it. Be prepared for these luxuries to go away. Okay. So Amos chapter 8. Amos chapter 8. Verse 1, the Lord showed me there was a basket of summer fruit. If you have a summer fruit that's in the basket, that means what has happened? Harvest has happened. He said, what do you see, Amos? And I said, a basket of summer fruit. And the Lord said to me, the end has come for my people of Israel. Okay, so it's definitely not more than 50 years. Remember, they're taken away. Do you remember what year roughly? 720 roughly. So it's not more than 50 years because we know when these kings are reigning. And it's probably closer to about 20 years from now. 25, 30, 20 years from now. All right. The Lord said, the end has come for my people. I will spare them no longer. The songs of the palace were turned to wailing in that day, declares the Lord. Many will be the corpses in every place. They will cast them forth in silence. Hear this, you who trample on the needy, to do away with the humble in the land, saying, when will the new moon come so that I can go and worship God according to the methods that he has prescribed? Is that what they're saying? No. Their point, the author's point, God's point is, their depravity and their abuse. They've sunk so low. When will the new moon be over so that we may sell grain and the Sabbath that we may open the wheat market to make the bushel smaller and the shekel bigger to cheat with the dishonest scales so as to buy the helpless for money? This is how depraved they are. But the God's prescribed ceremonies are inconveniences for these people. Could you imagine that? You have two people. One person can't wait for the next time God's prescribed ceremony comes. He says, what? I can't wait. When is it going to be? The other one can't wait for it to be over. When can we get this done with? So it's such a large inconvenience. One says, this is such an inconvenience on my life. The other one says, I can't conceive of my life without it. The question is, what? Which am I? Now, by the way, can you think of a one-to-one correlation? Back then, the new moon. When will the new moon be over? Who told them to do the new moon? Right. Does God tell us to do the new moon? No, but what does he tell us to do? Sundays. And when the church assembles. But especially, specifically, doing the Lord's Supper and everything else that's said. Look, some people come, you know, mankind has not changed, although some would like to say that it has. Mankind has not changed. And there could be somebody who is waiting for the assembly to be over, just like these people waited for the new moon to be over. The question is, who am I? And look at the results. Verse 7. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, indeed, I will never forget any of their deeds. Because of this, will not the land quake, and everyone who dwells in it mourn? Indeed, all of it will rise up like the Nile. It will be tossed about and subside like the Nile of Egypt. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that I will make the sun go down at noon and the earth dark in broad daylight. Then I will turn your festivals into mourning and all your songs into lamentation, and I will bring sackcloth on everyone's loins and baldness on every head, and I will make it a time of mourning for an only son, and the end will be like a bitter day. Oh, joy. Fine. Was it worth it? No. And guess what? By the way, the whole point of this language is that their world is going to be turned upside down. It's going to be a dark, dark day for them. And he hasn't even gotten to the worst part. The worst part of it is this. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will send a famine on the land. Not a famine for bread or for water, but rather for the hearing of the words of the Lord. People will stagger from sea to sea, from the north even to the east. They will go to and fro and seek the word of the Lord, but they will not find it. In that day, the beautiful virgins and the young men will faint from thirst as those who swear from the guilt of Samaria, who say, as your God lives, O Dan, and as the way of Beersheba lives, they will fall and they will not rise again. Was it worth it? Absolutely not. Something interesting, the worst thing that could possibly happen to a society is losing what? Sorry, say it.
Their God.
The fear of God. The fear of God, the knowledge of God. Did you see that? Days are coming. Out of all this, there's going to be bad stuff, bad stuff, bad stuff. And included in that, I'm going to send a famine. I'm going to take away the word. Turn to Hosea chapter 4. Hosea 4, verse 1. Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel. Remember, you did this in preparation for this class or last class. Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. Okay, so there's no knowledge. Huh, I wonder what there is then. There's no faithfulness. There's no kindness. Verse 2, swearing, deception, murder, stealing, adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. That's a way of saying that this thing is multiplied. Bloodshed is all over the place. Why? Because there is no knowledge of the Lord. Fun. No. You don't ever want to live in a place where there is no knowledge of the Lord. Here's something else at the same time. This society, the depravity of a society is directly related to whether or not it adheres to God's Word. I'm going to take away the Word. I'm going to take away knowledge of me. And guess what's going to happen to your society? Guess. It's going to fall apart just like this. Your government cannot fix your problems, folks. Not this problem. The only thing that can fix this problem is when the majority or every single person in the society says, I will voluntarily submit to that law. And until every person does, you're going to have problems in that society. And the fewer and fewer and fewer people that do, the more chaos your society will be. Don't think the government's going to come and, our nation's getting worse and worse and worse. Government will fix it. No. The only thing that will is when we volunteer to adhere to the standard. Comments or questions?
So if you keep going in Hosea 4,
yeah.
Verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a high priest or being a priest to me.
Right, right. It's especially God's people. That's what we thrive and live on, right? Okay. So in chapter 9, chapter 9 is directed to both the north and the south. For example, in verse 11, we'll talk about the booth of David. That's toward the south. But also, most of the book is toward the north, okay? Also, there are some in Israel, and apparently in Judah too, remember Jeremiah chapter 7, that are trusting in their relationship with God. Verse 10 of chapter 9, verse 10 says, those who say the calamity will not overtake or confront us, you see, they're privileged. Oh, we're Israel. God's not going to do anything to us. All right, God is addressing that in this chapter. I saw the Lord standing beside the altar. Smite the capitals. Those are those little sticky up things on the corners of the... Okay? So he says, destroy the thresholds. They will shake. Break them on the heads of them all. Then I will slay the rest of them with the sword. And they will not have a fugitive who will flee or a refugee who will escape. I'm coming. I'm going to destroy what you think is the most holy thing there is, which is the temple, as he's talking about. I'm going to destroy that, your place where you come to communicate with me. And not only that, I'm going to use it to destroy you, and I'm going to make sure that all of you are dead. He's being very thorough. Verse 2, though they dig into Sheol, from there my hand will take them. Though they ascend to the heaven, from there I will bring them. Though they hide on the summit of Carmel, I will search them out and take them. Though they conceal themselves from my sight in the floor of the sea, as high as you can possibly go, to as low as you can possibly go, you will not get away from him. He is going to come, and he's going to get them. From there I will command the serpent, and it will bite them. And though they go into captivity before their enemies, even in captivity, from there I will command the sword and slay them. Remember in Jeremiah 44, Jeremiah says, look, if you go into Egypt, what's going to happen? They're all going to be, you're going to be taken. You can't hide in Egypt. That's what he's saying here. The Lord of hosts, the one who touches the land so that it melts, and all those who dwell in it mourn. And all that rises up like the Nile and subsides like the Nile of Egypt, the one who builds his upper chambers in the heavens and has founded his vaulted dome over the earth. He who calls the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth, the Lord is his name. Are you not the sons as the sons of Ethiopia? He's going to say right here, you are no different from anybody else, O sons of Israel. In one way, they're not any different. Have I not brought up Israel from the land of Egypt and the Philistines from Captor and the Arameans of Kir? And look what he did to all them. He judges all of them. He said, look, you're no different from everybody else. I brought you up from there. I brought them up from there. I conquered them. I punished them. I'm going to punish you too. Behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from the face of the earth. How sad. He is going to destroy his chosen people. Do you remember who Jeroboam was? Who was he? Yeah, which the first one? What did he do? Who was he? He was the first. king of the north, right? So that's what we're talking about here, mostly the north. Okay, he's the first king of the north, and he did what? Introduced the golden calf in the north and Dan and Bethel. Okay, now, where is he now as we read this text right now? Amos is alive. Where's Jeroboam when Amos is alive? He's dead. What was he doing? There's a little bit of speculation going on, but not much. What do you think Jeroboam was doing when Amos was writing? We turn to Luke 16, where there's a parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man is saying, send somebody back to warn them. Regretting. Regret. I imagine Jeroboam's right there with him. Right? Say, yes, please, send somebody back. He would scream if he could. Listen, God will do it. God will kill us. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Never forget, when God says that he will punish, he will punish. I'll make this point twice. If they can't get away with it, then I can't. We can't get away with it. So don't even start to think like that, right? Okay. Behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom. And I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Nevertheless, I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. What? He won't totally destroy it? Now, let's pretend we're reading our Old Testament for the first time ever. What had we never heard before that sentence? You remember back in Deuteronomy 28, 29, 30? What did he say? If you sin, I will. Up until now, we're starting to hear this. Yeah, here comes the punishment I talked about back then. Here comes the punishment I talked about back then. But what did we never heard before now? I will not totally destroy you. This is new information.
He does tell him that they turn and call on him, you will restore
him. Yes, okay. But in his prophecies of, you're going to go in Deuteronomy, I'm going to take you, I'm going to disperse you, I'm going to totally destroy you in all the land. We don't ever hear of, and then I'm going to bring some of you back. We do hear of the everlasting condition of repentance. It's implied, but we never really read it until now. Not explicitly. Okay. So, there's a little bit of new information, whether or not you could get it from implication before, but there's going to be more new information. I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. For, behold, I am commanding, and I will shake the house of Israel among all the nations. A grain, as a grain is shaken in a sieve, but not a kernel, will fall to the ground. Kernel, what is that talking about? Well, the opposite is in verse 10. All the sinners of my people will die by the sword. So the kernel, it's a metaphor, right? The kernel, the good, the chaff is going to fall. But the good people, they will be saved through this. All the sinners of my people will die by the sword. Those who say the calamity will not overtake us or confront us. In that day, more information, I will raise up the fallen booth of David. Two things about this, actually. Number one, this is implying that Israel in the south is going to fall, which he hasn't really been talking about yet, but here it is. But not only will it fall, but it will come back. Okay. And wall up its breaches. I will also raise up its ruins and rebuild them in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Eden and all the nations who are called by my name, declares the Lord. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper. There's going to be such abundance that they aren't going to be able to the farmers aren't going to be able to keep up with what the land is producing. The treader of the grapes will overtake he who sows the seed. The mountains will drip with sweet wine, and all the hills will be dissolved. Also, I will restore the captivity of my people Israel. And they will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out of their land, which I have given to them, thus says the Lord. This goes along with Hosea 1, 2, and 3. So Hosea 1. Hosea 1, 2, and 3, there was a pattern. The first part is bad, the second part is good. I'm just going to skip to the second part. Verse 10 of chapter 1. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. I'm going to destroy you, but in the future, things are going to be good. Chapter 2, the same thing. I'll skip it because it's long. Chapter 3, afterward, verse 5, Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Now, I find this interesting. In chapter 9, so far what we read is, I'm going to totally destroy you. But in the middle of that, or the end of it, he says, I'm not going to destroy all of you. You remember the kernels that will fall to the ground, will not fall to the ground? Not a kernel will fall to the ground. Chapter 9, verse 9 in Amos. Not a kernel will fall to the ground. The sinners, oh, they'll be destroyed everywhere, but not a kernel. Now, that's obviously figurative language. But picture it. Here goes all of Israel, and later on all of Judah. For you guys, they're going to go all over here, all to Assyria, and then all to Babylon. They're all going to go together. Huh, that's funny. It looks like the faithful's going with them. What would they be thinking? Wait a minute. What about me? And right here God says, don't worry about it. I've got you under control. No, I never told you that in Deuteronomy 28:29 and other places that when you were going away that I had some special arrangement for my saved people. And you're going to think to yourself, wait a minute, I'm being treated just like they are. Does God not care for me? And God says, don't worry. God cares for you. Even though you're going away with them, you've got your hook in their hook in your jaw, just like the sinner behind you. God still has paid attention, and he knows, and your faith has not been in vain. Keep it up. They read this and they say, oh, okay, I'm going to be treated the same, but God knows what's going on.
If they had the right mindset, and I can't say that I would in that situation because that's hard. But even if they kill him, he's just going to go home to God that much sooner.
Right. Yeah. Right. If you have that attitude, whether or not we do have that attitude, the question is this: he had said that he was going to shake the nations. The question for us is: are we ready for a shaking? Remember, we read this not only to find out about them, but so that we can apply it to ourselves. Are you ready for a shaking? I wonder if anybody... Oh, it's a video. Oh, that's interesting. Whoops, no video for you guys. Didn't know it was a video. Okay, so if you pay any attention to the news lately, there's a whole lot going on in the Middle East, and I don't want to cause undue alarm. That's not really my point. Other than somebody who's thinking about running for president said, look, they're not going to be content over there until they come over here. Okay, you know what I'm talking about, right? ISIS. How do they treat their women? All right, so I had a picture that you need to see. If you probably have seen it. In Amos 4, the Lord is talking to the people of Israel. And he says to them, verse 2, the Lord has sworn by his holiness. Behold, Amos 4, verse 2, behold, the days are coming upon you when they will take you away with meat hooks and the last of you with fish hooks. Have any of you seen the pictures of the women, not with meat hooks and fish hooks, but in chains? Have you seen the pictures? They're chained together. They're going to a meat factory. That's what they have become now. Okay? This is exactly... When God said that he was going to line them up and take them away with meat hooks and fish hooks, that wasn't because the Assyrians were nice people. They were evil, evil people. And that was probably the beginning of the bad that would happen to them. Well, if you look on the pictures, you'll see over there that what are they doing with these women? What are they doing with the men? Shooting them. What are they doing with the women? They're lining them up, they're putting chains on their wrists, and they're taking them to market. Now, again, I don't mean to cause undue alarm, but what if they do? What if we were over there? What if there is a Christian over there? What do they have to be ready for? This. God says in Amos chapter 9, look, I know you faithful one. You're going hand in hand with those unfaithful ones. But don't you worry. I've got it under control. But look at me. I've got a hook through my chin. God says, I know. And they will pay. But don't you give up. Your faith is not in vain. Over and over, that's his point to them. Comments or questions here? Yes, sir.
The concept of the remnant is kind of what they're talking about in Romans. I'm working on my Romans 9 questions today. And I mean, this is, it's not exactly what he's referring to, but he's referring to concepts like this when he's arguing about, you know, who the promises is for. And it's just kind of interesting to see the other end chronologically of that system.
Can you read this from there?
No.
These are my Romans 9 questions.
You have them out? Okay.
Because I asked a question, which I'm going to ask tonight. Has anybody else done the Romans 9 questions yet? Okay, all right, that's okay. But the point is what George is saying. We'll get there in just a minute. You might want to say more? Okay. So, we're going to get there roughly right now. There's a bunch of new information in here. First of all, the return and rebuild. Okay, that's the first time this is explicitly said. I'm going to bring you back. Okay. There's the day of the Lord in chapter 5. Verse 18, alas, you who are longing for the day of the Lord. I've mentioned this before. This is the first time we read this expression, the day of the Lord. Where are my notes? Yeah, okay, so the day of the Lord itself is mentioned 5 times in the major prophets and 14 times in the minor prophets. And that day, referring to the day of the Lord, is, 112 times in the major and minor prophets. So, of these 150 or so times, a little bit less, 150 times the day of the Lord is referred to in the Old Testament, here's the first one. So again, here's some new information. Now, it's new information for them, although you can tell from Amos that they had been talking about it, this is the first time we read about it. But why are we going to start paying attention to the day of the Lord and all this new information that we're talking about? We're going to pay attention to it for 2 reasons. Number one, to understand God's will for them and for us. And there's another reason that we pay attention to this, because some people
misinterpret it.
Right. We'll talk about that in just a second. In chapter 9, in verse 15, Amos 9 and verse 15, I will plant them on their land, and they will not be again rooted out from their land, which I have given to them. Okay, so he's given them the land, he's going to take them away and disperse them among the nations, and then he's going to bring them back, and when he puts them there, they're not going to leave again. Yes! Where is this modified? Daniel. Exactly. We're going to go on for another 400 years or so. Read 200 years. We're going to read. I'm going to bring you back to the land. You'll stay there. I'll bring you back to the land. I'll stay there. And if it weren't for Daniel, you'd think, oh, he's going to bring them back to the land, and they're going to stay there until he gets to Daniel chapter. Do you remember? Chapter 9, the 70 weeks. That's the first time where he says, oh, guess what, guys? There's going to be some major... They think, look, when we come back to the land, it's going to be nothing but glory, and we're going to stay in the land forever and ever and ever. And that's because that's what you read. But when we come to Daniel chapter 9, chronologically, for the first time, he starts talking about the 70 weeks, right? Well, verse 26, I'll just read. After the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off. Wait a minute, the Messiah is supposed to stay forever. The Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war, desolations are determined. Wait a minute. It was supposed to be eternal peace and prosperity once we get back to the land. No, that's actually modified too. So just be aware of that and keep on being aware of that while we go on reading through our Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And then we come to Daniel. I was in Daniel 9, verse, what did I say, 37, something like that. 36? 26? There is no 37. Right. Right, verse 27. Complete destruction is decreed. One that makes one... He's talking about AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem. It's going to be gone. It's going to be like Hiroshima, right?
Sometimes the rapture people, the premillennialists and such people, use this as part of their rapture.
Right. Right. The thing is they don't have it positioned properly, right? And that's basically what George was talking about. So the ESV study, well, John MacArthur writes the ultimate on Amos chapter 9, talking about, look, when they come back and they get stuck in the land, the ultimate restoration of Israel. God will raise up and rebuild this tabernacle on earth for Christ to rule in his millennial kingdom. The ESV study Bible says the same thing. Oh, the ESV study Bible says, this final blessing of the people is predicated upon their recognition of their Davidic Messiah, something that is yet to occur. And guess what passage they say to go see? It's yet to occur. All Israel is going to be saved. You remember? We're going to cover it. Romans 11. Romans 11. He says, go on. See Romans 11, verses 25 through 27. That's why I brought my Romans 9 questions, because I ask a question about Romans 11 in my Romans 9 questions, okay? Because remember I've said in Romans, we're now starting to talk about why the nation? Why the nation? That's Romans 9 through Romans 11, and that's going to talk about why the nation, and it's tied right back into Amos chapter 9, among many other places. So it's all tied in together, and it's all very complex and intricate. Yes, thank you. But it's all that we have to deal with it, little piece by little piece. Comments or questions on this? Okay. We'll go to Hosea. Hosea, you did the questions. This part of Hosea, I believe, takes place at the same time as Amos. I believe chapter 4 through 14 of Hosea takes place later. I could show you why, but Hosea 4 through 14 starts talking about all they're doing to go and call out to the nations of Egypt and Assyria for military help. And that hasn't happened as much as it will happen in just a little bit. Okay. Amos. Hosea. Hosea chapter 1. For now, I'm not going to cover all the good that's going to happen when they return, which is the second part of each of these chapters, right? You're going to go away, and then you're going to return. It's going to be glorious. We'll deal with that a little bit later, not today. For now, Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord, which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, so see some of it much later on, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, which is where we are right now, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry. Why a harlot? It's an object, right? He's going to take and say, remember, he'll have Isaiah, or I think it's Ezekiel, that will lie on his side for weeks upon weeks, and then he'll turn to the other side. So God uses the object lessons. One of them is, you go and get married to somebody who is going to cheat on you. Why? Verse 2, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So it's an object lesson. Look, I want you to go and marry a harlot because that's what the land is doing. And they'll look at you and they'll say, oh, this is what we're doing too. Okay. Here's a question for you. How did Israel commit harlotry against the Lord? Can you think of any ways? Idolatry. Any other ways? They didn't obey him. That's what's stated right here, actually, about Jehu in the Valley of Jezreel. He obeyed him, but he had the wrong motive. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do. A third reason, which will come more prevalent, is that they will, when they get in trouble, when they need military might, who do they go to? God? They keep on going to Egypt and to Assyria. Okay. For the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. By the way, of all of the children, that is the only one that is indicated was his child. The rest she had, but it doesn't say it was born to him. The Lord said to him, name him Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I would never forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by the bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. Then when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son, and the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. And then he goes on to say, look, but in the future, I'm going to call you back. Chapter 2, verse 1. Here's the question. Why so graphic? For example, say to your brothers Ammi and your sisters Ruhamah, contend with your mother. Contend, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband. Let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her as the day that she was born, and I will make her like the wilderness and her like a desert land and slay her with thirst. Oh, joy. Why so graphic? It's important. And what is he doing?
Making sure they have no defense.
Okay.
Driving it home. How serious is sin?
Exactly. This, I mean, you read language like that in the Bible, and you say, something's going on here. What's going on? And God is trying to get them to see sin is disgusting. And unfaithfulness will be punished. There is no out. There is no way to escape it. This is what he's saying over and over again. So let me ask this question of you. How can we cheat on God? How can we cheat on God? We have a relationship. That's the picture here. You're married. There's a picture like that in the New Testament, right? So how can we cheat on God? Which is?
Going over after anything that's not God.
That's right. That's a pretty blanket statement.
Yeah.
Going after anything that's not God. That's right.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Anything maybe more specific? Less?
Basically, if you're forsaking God and spending more time doing other things than you are worshiping God and studying.
With your time.
Yeah.
Misusing your time. Going after anything. Misusing your time, going after anything. Gary?
You just covered one. Their attitude.
Right.
Your attitude, you know, from those services. And, you know, what was their attitude towards the beast?
Right. Right. Attitude. In fact, I'm reminded when we think of attitude of Revelation chapter 2, he writes to the church in Ephesus that you have left your
first love.
Same kind of language, same kind of idea, right? Oh, here's one. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? May it never be. Or do you not know that he who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee immorality. There's another example. Back here in Hosea, no, actually, it was Amos that I'm thinking of. No, chapter, look here. Okay. What you do with your material possessions. Do you remember what it said in Amos, what she did with her material possessions? What did she do with them? Gave them to the nations. In fact, verse 8, for example, she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished upon her the silver and gold, which she used for Baal. Remember that. Do not participate with the deeds of darkness, right? Instead, what are we supposed to do? Expose them, right? Do not participate. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 talks about what partnership has. Same thing. And in this case, they're giving their material possessions. So let me suggest this. When there's a bad movie and you go and pay your cash to see it, what's the difference? Nothing. Right? There's a drink over there that God says, don't touch. And you go and you take your cash or your credit or whatever you got and you get the drink. What are you doing? The same thing. We could name 1,000 different specific applications of this. My main point is, I guess I'll avoid these things, right? Whatever causes me to be a harlot towards the Lord. In chapter 3, verse 1, this is actually a message of hope. Chapter 3, verse 1, Hosea 3, verse 1. Then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband. yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. Okay, the idea is he's not saying go get somebody else's wife. Hosea loved his wife, yet she ran off, and God says, okay, she ran off, no, go get her back. Because that fits the picture of what he's trying to tell him about Israel. Israel was with God, they had a great relationship at Mount Sinai, and then it all went downhill from there, and they went off, and they played the harlot, and God says to Hosea, look, you go, you get her back. Even though she's been a harlot, you get her back. Because I'm doing the same thing, God says. Go again. Love a woman who is loved by her husband. God loved Israel. Yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. So I brought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer of and a half of barley. Then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. The object lesson continues. So you shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be to you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. And afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Look, they have totally abused him, and what is he saying to them? Come back. That's what I want. What a loving God we have. What did we, every single person in here at one time said to God, I don't want you. I want some other man to carry out the picture, right? But we say, he keeps on crying out to us saying, no, please come back to me. Please come back to me. What a loving God we have. Okay, comments or questions from Hosea chapters 1 through 3. That's all I'm going to cover for now. We'll come back to the good parts. All right, so chronologically, we now go back to where we left off. 2 Kings chapter 14. Verse 23 talked about Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. That's who we've been covering this whole time. When we went to Amos and then Hosea, they both talk about prophesying in the days of Jeroboam. But Jeroboam died, we already covered that. Chapter 15... we actually have already covered Azariah, the king of the south, which brings us to verse 8, chapter 15, 2 Kings 15, verse 8. In the 38th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in Samaria for 6 months. He did evil. Verse 13, so there was a conspiracy against him. Shalom, the son of Jabez, became king. He reigned 1 month. And then, verse 17, there's a conspiracy against him. Menahem reigns for 10 years in Samaria, and he does evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart all his days from the sins of Jeroboam. And so this king from Assyria, Pul, comes along and starts taking away bits and pieces of Israel as punishment. Well, whatever your country is getting smaller and smaller, then typically there's a change in rulership. Verse 23, in the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, became king over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 2 years, and he did evil. Well, they don't like that, so in verse 27, they get Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years, and he does evil. Well, here comes Tiglath-Pileser, who is the same guy, Pul, again, verse 29. He comes, he takes away more. He carries them away captive, verse 29, captive to Assyria. So the first wave of captives go. Verse 30, Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah. He'll pick up in chapter 17, verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king over Israel. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. Okay, all these kings are doing evil, 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 evil. What do we know is going to happen to them? What do we know? And in fact, we don't even have to have read the rest of the story. What do we know will happen? They're all doing evil. What's going to happen? Sorry? Punishment. Punishment. Right, they're going to take him away. Say, sorry, God. Yeah. Jinx you owe each other a coke. God is going to say, hey, look, that's it. Now, why do we know? Why do we know punishment will happen? It's not because we've read the rest of the story that we know punishment will happen. It's because we've read... Exactly. We've already... Go ahead.
God said what happened.
Right. God said... He said, if you do evil, I'll take you away. If it happens to them, then what can we expect? Same thing. If they didn't get away with it, then I can't expect to get away with it. So never ever think that, oh, I'm special. Not me. No, it's not going to apply to me. I get to get away with this thing or that thing or every other thing that I'm doing when God says no. If you sin and you do not repent, you will be judged for it. In Menahem's day, so all these kings are evil and there's not much said about them at all. But in Menahem, in verse 17 of chapter 15, Menahem becomes king. He does evil. Verse 19, Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver so that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his rule. Then Menahem exacted the money from Israel, from even all the mighty men of the wealth, and from each man 50 shekels of silver to pay the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria returned and did not remain there in the land. Yes, success. They now have peace in the land again. Was it successful? Did they have peace? Even if it lasted forever, would it actually have been successful? Why not? Further away from their God.
I was just saying, God told them not to make alliances with these other nations.
Their means, their method. Did they secure peace? Yes, but what was wrong with the way they secured the peace? How were they supposed to get peace? Pray to God. Here comes this big army. God, please help me. Bam! Instead, they dole out the cash. Here's the cash. Here's the cash. The point is this. God wants us to live in peace. But the way we acquire the peace is we have to trust in God. Right? We can't just get peace any way we want to. But doesn't God want me to be happy? Have you ever heard it? What is that usually, at least the context I have most often heard it in reference to?
Remarriage.
Exactly. But God, wrong divorce, if we're to get into another marriage, it will be unlawful. That, so you go and you say it to him, not that, exactly like that. And... Right. And the reply is, but doesn't, either it's amen, thank you for pointing that out to me, or very often, too sadly enough, it's but wouldn't God want me to be happy? Yes, he does want you to be happy, but there's only one way to get happiness.
He said, if you obey him, you will be, you should
right,
be happy.
Right, right. Because he tells you to be, even though you can't get back with your wife or your husband that you've divorced because they've gone off and gotten a bad marriage or whatever the case might be. He tells us, whatever your station you're in, if you can get out of that and get back into the right one, then do it. But if you can't, what should be your mindset? Being content? Right? No, I will try to get back into that relationship that I unlawfully ended. However, if I cannot get back into that relationship, then I've got to live the rest of my life content because we have God and a relationship with him. Of course, that applies not just to wrong marriages and such things. Comments or questions here?
I'm almost going to picture that they, in some way, they kind of trusted in their wealth.
Right.
You kind of get that picture. You know, it says he exacted the usury, the money from the very wealthy.
Right.
But you know, hey, that guy's out of this jam, all this money.
Problem with money is it dries up. That's and the love of money is the root of all. Yeah, and unless you got a tree somewhere, you know, it doesn't keep on coming. I will make this last point that I have to make. It actually concerns Jotham in verse 32 of chapter 15. So now we transition back to the southern king, the southern kingdom. Verse 32, in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jerusha, and the daughter of Zadok. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all his father Uzziah had done. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense in the high places. He built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. Now, the rest of the acts of Jotham and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? In those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So the northern kingdom in Assyria is going to come down and try to beat up on Judah. All right. Something is said, and I really wish I had my charts for this, but that's okay. In verse 34, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Verse 35, only the high places were not taken away. Have we read this before? So-and-so did what was right in the sight of the Lord, except the high places weren't taken away. Now, yes. Right. Well, actually, it was before. It was already going on in the time of Solomon. Okay. Solomon built more. Okay. Actually, Solomon built, I should say, others more. Well, that would be the same thing, right? Yes, Solomon did do it, but if you read 1 Kings 4, verse 3, or something like that, it says that these were already going on, even in the days of David, because the temple had not yet been built, is what it says. Right. Right. Okay. So, here, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. And always, every time we read it, or let me be careful how you interpret what I say. Verse 35, only the high places were not taken away. Do you see how they're always together? He did right in the sight of the Lord, but there's always a little disclaimer.
Asterisk.
Yeah, an asterisk. What does this proximity seem to imply about responsibility? He didn't do everything he should have. And specifically, the thing he should have done, but he did not, was get rid of the high places. All right. This goes back to what book and what chapter? Do you remember? God says earlier, a way long time ago, he said, I'm going to give you a place to worship. And you don't run around everywhere in every high place like they're doing here. Deuteronomy 12. Okay, so Deuteronomy 12, he says, verses 1 through 12. He says, when you get into the land, you're not going to do what everybody's been doing here, but I'm going to give you one place to worship. First it's Shiloh, then it's Gibeah, and then it's Jerusalem. All right. So it gives them this one place. Now, later on, we'll see them actually doing what they shouldn't be doing. They're doing what they shouldn't be doing. We see it already happening in 1 Kings. Later on, these high places won't be taken down until, do you remember who? Hezekiah before him. Then who's Hezekiah's son? Manasseh. Manasseh puts them back up, and then Josiah. Josiah comes along, and he takes them back down. Okay, so right now they're still up. These high places have been up. They're still up. The king is responsible. He's not taking them down yet. Oh, by the way, do you remember in Joshua chapter 22, is it? When the northern tribes that were the Transjordanian tribes were going to go back. Remember what they built?
A little altar by the river.
And you remember what everybody else's problem was?
It was a
Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy 12. That's what, you can't build that altar. It's a copy of the altar. And they said, no, our purpose is different. Okay. But the point is, this is serious, serious stuff. Yet, these kings, several times, are stated, it said, they did good, only this. And it's almost like, they did all right, there's this over here, but we'll overlook that. That's the way I read it. Do you read it differently?
No, I read it as almost like a political thing.
Okay.
That the people have to keep the people back.
Okay.
That's kind of the way I read it. You know,
okay.
Because the people have been doing it for so long.
Okay.
Because then when Josiah comes along, he does everything.
Right, right, right.
By his time, they've been doing it so long, their hearts are so ingrained that they can't turn their hearts.
Yes, it says that. They keep on doing evil. Okay, but my question isn't why he doesn't do it. My real question is this. Okay, we talk about following the pattern.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the way we talk about, the way I talk about following the pattern, it doesn't, what's going on here? Because he ain't following the pattern. But yet, it is said that He did all right. Now, let me ask, let me remind us. Remember Joshua 22. What were they going to do? They were going to kill. They were going to wipe out 2.5 tribes for doing the wrong thing. That's how serious they took it. Okay, so these prophets, were they supposed to, the normal people, were they supposed to figure out the law? Yes. Were they supposed to keep the law as best as they could? Yes. Were they supposed to teach the law? Yes. Do you think there was a prophet that wasn't saying, you've got to go and tear down those high places? Let me reword it. Every prophet would come along and say, tear down the high places. And it was wrong that they did not. We have to figure out what God says. We have to figure out what God says. We have to do what God says to the best of our ability. And then we have to teach others. We must teach others what God says. Now, having said that, I'm somewhat surprised, or maybe I learned something about God here. As much as I have to do it, and I have to figure it out, and I have to teach others to it, when somebody else is not doing it, I can judge their actions. They didn't do it. But what can't I judge? Their hearts. He was not doing what he should have done. And all I can do is run around and say, you're not doing what you should do. I'm not doing what I should do. At the same time, he did, what does it say? He was doing right in the sight of the Lord. My point is this, God can make whatever decision he wants to. At the same time, he is giving me limited knowledge, and I have to abide by that knowledge. I've got to run around and say, here's the pattern, here's the pattern, here's the... You're not doing the pattern. You've got to do the pattern, you've got to do the pattern. But what about... And I'd say, God can do what he wants, but I need to tell you, here is the pattern. Now, there's one reason why I bring that up. Next week, Thursday night, we're going to have a gospel meeting on following the pattern. Right? We must follow the pattern. We've got to figure it out. We've got to do it. We've got to teach others it. And never forget that. And we've got to judge others' actions. But when we see somebody, I received an email this week. The question was, why aren't these people doing the pattern? And I had to, and the attitude was, we need to go over there and rip their heads off. Right. No. They're not doing the pattern. And do they need to be instructed? Absolutely. But our attitude should not be, so let's go over there and rip their heads off, right? God will judge them. In the meantime, let's take care of ourselves. Let's figure out what it is, obey it, and then teach others it. But let him judge people's actions or people's souls. Comments or questions on this?
There were some good kings, as we can see here, and I was just thinking, listening to this, yeah, they were perfect, they ignored some things, they let the whims of the people go. I'm beginning to think I need to start praying for a godly king instead of a godly president, you know, and we will hit a point perhaps as these things go away, this whole thing started with a discussion of our freedom or whatever, that doesn't mean that it will be horrible all the time, maybe it will.
Correct.
But that doesn't rule out the possibility of having a godly, respectable person in the situation that we are allowed to do what is the right thing to do by their graciousness, as it were. But, you know.
Yeah. Anybody else? Thank you. We went long. You did well. You participated in keeping your eyes open and even speaking at time to time. Who has...